Hello, Market Watcher. I'm David Revelle, and this is a special edition of Value Side for Saturday, October 2nd. Today, the American producers shine. That, plus today's economic report, as well as the latest in corporate earnings, coming right up. Well, this week the American producers shone, putting in a series of performances which, when you add them all up, paint an incredible picture of a group of people who are ready and willing to set this nation on the right track economically. Unfortunately, few saw this remarkable job, and if they did, they downplayed it, or worse yet, ignored it. Too often the media in this country either doesn't comprehend or appreciate the labor and effort that goes into really making our commercial system work. Many, I'm afraid, really don't know where this country's wealth and prosperity comes from, who it is that pays the taxes, that builds the schools, the infrastructure, and defense that provides for our way of life. The spenders, we call them politicians, take all the glory, but it is the producers who actually pay the bills. This week, we got some real insight into how those producers are doing currently and how the economy stands right now. In four measures, we saw that American producers are moving into the future, establishing the next chapter in our economic growth. The first came on Monday and answered the question, how exactly are producers building the next generation of plant and equipment? In accounting, we have a term for this. These purchases are called durable goods. They're that new piece of equipment, or the plant, that will carry businesses through to tomorrow. They're those big-ticket items, the long-lasting purchases a business must make to meet today's challenges. They're long-term buys, and they're durable. In August, American producers increased their purchases of durable goods by 1.8%. Four times greater than Wall Street had expected, a sure sign that American producers are gearing up for the future. This bodes very well. Then on Friday, we got yet another indication that American producers are gearing up to make a better economic future. It's called the Purchasing Managers Index. And if you listen to this podcast often, we talk about this index a lot, because it's the first real indication of a producer's immediate plans. Purchasing managers buy the raw materials and components that manufacturers will use to make their finished goods. The rubber to make tires, the lumber to build houses, the steel to make cars. And when the purchasing manager goes out to buy, you know the producer is committed to building the project. Here again, the American producers far outshone the rest of the world. There were two measures of purchasing managers' indexes, one by Marquette and one by the Institute for Supply Management. And by both measures, American producers scored over 60. No other country scored so high. It's as if the rest of the world is stuck in second gear, while American producers are speeding along in high gear. And interestingly, America's chief rivals, Russia and China, showed that their purchasing managers scored only in the high 40s, well behind the Americans. Finally, there were a pair of economic measures, one which was barely noticed, and I'm afraid the other which was totally ignored. The first was the nation's gross domestic product, the sum total of all the goods and services produced in the country for the second quarter. In other words, this is our best measure of the output of the total economy. Now, by this measure, the economy grew at a remarkable 6.7%, far above the most optimistic Wall Street estimates going into the actual accounting, which began last July. In actual dollars, this means that the U.S. economy grew by more than $1.25 trillion. That's an increase in our economy which was greater than the total economies of Mexico, the Netherlands, or Indonesia. It's a remarkable feat, and yet you likely heard little of it, and only in passing, as the news spent little time on this stunning accomplishment by the American producers. Yet while this outstanding measure of the economy garnered only a little amount of notice, the next accomplishment by American producers attracted, as far as I could tell, absolutely no attention at all. And that measure was the American corporate profits. Profits were up by 10.5%, double what anyone thought would happen. After paying all of their expenses, providing salaries for all employees, paying rent, and most importantly, paying taxes, still, American producers retained $2.44 trillion so that they could pay themselves and invest in the future, buy those durable goods, and provide the purchasing managers with their funds to buy. And this is it, the heart and the soul of our system. It is what made us as great as we are. This is the magical elixir which has built the schools, provided the medicine, made the infrastructure, and defended our shores for years. It is, after all, on the back of these profits upon which the long-term viability of this nation depends. Oh, sure, for a short time we can borrow to maintain our lifestyle, but long-term viability only comes through the profits generated by the American producers. And the last quarter's profits were the best ever. $2.44 trillion worth of profits that we can now rely on to move us forward as a country. So let's raise a glass of the bubbly, a tip of the hat, to the American producers. It was a job well done. Now coming up, a look back at this week's market comments. If it weren't for the last minute, I wouldn't get anything done. Well, that old joke seems to apply to Washington this week. In just 4 days, the government's fiscal year will end, and we will need a budget to proceed. In true form, Nancy Pelosi has informed her side of the aisle to be prepared for 3 critical votes this week. I believe that this is the beginning of a major change in Washington's role in the economy, as Washington will go from stimulus to restraint. This week, the House of Representatives will begin the process with their struggle to approve the 2022 budget. As part of that budget will come the higher taxes that Ms. Pelosi and the Democrats have promised. This will mark a major departure from the policy that the federal government has pursued since back in 2017. You'll remember that back then, at the end of 2017, Congress passed the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, specifically designed by the Trump administration to promote hiring and support businesses. This week, Congress will change all that. Now, the rationale for this latest move is to, quote, pay for all the stimulus. Of course, that's not possible. It's not possible to pay for all of the trillions of dollars that Congress shoveled out the door last year. But whatever the rationale, the reality will be that raising taxes, especially corporate taxes, will present a major headwind to the economy. The Biden-proposed tax increase will raise corporate rates from 21 to 28%, or a bump up of about a third. By any measure, this is one of the largest tax increases in history. And rather than a phased-in approach, this will hit all at once. And it's bound to have a major impact on American corporations. Now we move across town for our next 2 likely changes in the way Washington approaches the economy. The Federal Reserve is also busy changing their approach. First up is likely to be the Fed's reduction in their major stimulus program, quantitative easing. That's the monthly purchase of U.S. Treasury bonds and notes. Right now, the Fed purchases each and every month $120 billion worth of these securities. Now, the design of this approach is to provide liquidity to the financial system. And while that's true, this monthly purchasing program has shielded the economy from the impact of all that mounting U.S. debt. All these stimulus programs have come with a price. and that price is paid in the form of those bonds needed to provide the stimulus. Look at it like our national credit card. First money is spent on the stimulus, then later the credit card payments come due in additional bonds. We must pay the interest and maturity on each of these bonds. Now, because these bonds are issued by the highest-rated, safest of all issuers, the U.S. government, they absorb a great deal of the economy's investable funds in a process economists call crowding out. And this is the process of U.S. debt taking funds away from the productive part of our economy, those growing small businesses which provide most of the new hires in the country and from which much of our economic growth derives. Crowding out begins when these bond purchases end, and by all appearances, that's going to happen very shortly. Now, last but certainly not least, the Fed is also making rumbles about raising interest rates. Here, the rationale is higher rates are needed to fight inflation. As you know, I don't support the thinking that we're in a permanent high inflation period. We've just gone through one of the biggest rebounds in history, following the sharpest drop in history. Couple this with the higher prices directly caused by the supply chain woes, and I think it's way too early to declare this as a high inflation period. Nonetheless, I do believe that the Fed will indeed raise rates, at least 25 basis points, and certainly within the next 12 months. That's the overall thinking on the street also, incidentally. So there you have a trifecta of tighter monetary policy: higher taxes, less quantitative easing, those bond purchases, and higher interest rates. If you were to design a strategy to slow this economy, you couldn't do much better than this. And it all begins this week with the passage by Congress of the 2022 federal budget. Well, the best way to find out where you're going is simply to get out a map. It tells you where you're headed. There's no emotion in a map, no hidden objectives, no political correctness. Today, OPEC, of all places, gave the United States a map. It tells us, as objectively as possible, exactly where our economy is headed. And to say that the news is bad is an understatement, although to the keen observer, it will not be unexpected. The map presented today is OPEC's World Oil Outlook. And because oil and energy are central components in any economy, just witness the troubles currently in Europe and China when talking about oil, this report spends a lot of time talking about the world's economies, and it projects out until 2045 just what the world will look like economically. Now, by 2045, the world is expected to add another 2.6 billion persons and achieve a total population of 9.5 billion. For the next 44 years, the world's total economy is expected to grow an average of almost 3% annually. That includes the world's developed nations, like the U.S. and China, as well as the world's developing nations. It's here that we come to a key concept in the report, a concept that in the nearly 50 years which I've been studying our economy has been completely turned on its head. It used to be a given that the more energy a country used, the faster that country's economy was growing. This was back in the days of Smokestack America, when the U.S. was the leading industrial powerhouse of the world. That's no longer the case. And it's no longer the case that American economists see the correlation between energy usage and industrial production. This report, however, points out this very essential correlation. According to the World Oil Outlook, published this morning, OPEC projects that total Chinese energy consumption will increase on average over 16,000 barrels per day in oil equivalent. China is sucking down oil and its equivalent, coal, hydro, and nuclear power, just as fast as they possibly can. On the other hand, the USA will consume less and less energy on average each and every day. The report indicates that each day for the next 44 years, U.S. energy consumption will decline 500 barrels per day. Think about that. Less energy usage by factories, reduced transportation, and overall a stagnant industrial sector. Now, the specious assumption has been that we've achieved this through our incredible advances in conservation. But the reality is that we've achieved this reduced energy use by shipping our factories overseas to places like China, which gladly use energy to produce the goods that they can now sell back to America. Many in this country will point to the chart on CO2 emissions in the report to show the success of the Americans. This chart shows that China produces twice the CO2, a questionable major of pollution, incidentally, but China will produce twice the CO2 that the Americans do, which in... Now, granted, reduced emissions are a worthwhile objective. Cleaner air makes a healthier environment for all our people. But there can be no doubt that American factories are the cleanest in the world and far ahead of China in their ability to reduce or eliminate pollutants. Pollution isn't the issue here, however. Economic growth is, and that challenge is how America can repower our industry. We will know we're on track when American industry uses more energy in a clean, non-polluting way. Now, the world oil outlook ends, like any map, with our destination. Assuming that we stay on the course we're on, here is where the U.S. and China will be in 44 years. For the U.S., the next 44 years are projected to be tepid at the very best, with marginal growth rates each year averaging just 2.3%. This corresponds directly with our unwillingness to use available energy. By 2045, the U.S. gross domestic product is projected to come in at less than $39 trillion. It's the result of what really is a very poor economic growth rate. And that's the key here. To remain competitive, the U.S. must find ways to increase our economic growth. For China, the year 2045 is a year of economic dominance. For 44 years, the Chinese economy is projected to grow at an average rate of 3.9% per year, nearly double the U.S. rate. Add that all up, and they will have an economy that has a gross domestic product of $64 trillion. No other country will be close. The United States will lag far behind China at that point. Perhaps it's time for the USA to change course. Well, yesterday Jerome Powell addressed the Senate Committee on Banking. Today, he'll address the House Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. These testimonies are an important way in which the Federal Reserve communicates with the legislators on the Hill. Adding to Powell's testimony today is the fact that the chairman's term comes up early next year, and it's not at all certain whether he will be reappointed. Standing in the way is Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Undoubtedly, Senator Warren will exert a great deal of influence over just who becomes the next Fed chairman. For some time, Warren and Powell have taken entirely different paths, with Warren unhappy over Powell's position on corporate governance and his views on inflation. So much so that yesterday Warren indicated that Powell's views were dangerous. Seeming to join in with Warren was chairman of the committee, Sherrod Brown. Now, for those who are not inclined to follow the somewhat arcane world of politics, I remind you of the dominant role that the government has played in this economy over the past year. First, it shut down the economy through social distancing, quarantine, and closing non-essential businesses. Then it was the government which reopened the economy and provided the strategy and funds needed to recover. I dare say that we would have to go back to the management of the economy under Franklin Roosevelt back in World War II to come up with a comparable time as this. So with all this background, Jerome Powell was treading on eggshells yesterday as he tried to make the case for the Fed's monetary strategy, first indicating that he felt that while we are going through a bout of high inflation now, he sees that as moderating at some point in the near future. Warren disagrees, and she sees high inflation far into the future. Now, trying to emphasize the positive, Powell noted the strong performance from the economy for the first half of the year, and he noted that the economy has gained 750,000 new jobs for the past 3 months, a hot point for both Brown and Warren. Overall, it seemed to me that Powell was portraying an economy that is ready to work its way back to normal, barring any unforeseen event, particularly any recurrence of the pandemic. In his handout to the senators, Chairman Powell pointed to the 4 support programs that have now been closed, having fulfilled their mission. The 4 closed programs are the Corporate Credit Facility, the Main Street Lending Program, the Municipal Liquidity Facility, and TALF, the Term Asset-Backed Security Loan Facility. Just a note here, this is exactly the overall direction that I see Powell and the Fed going in for the rest of the year, with a likely significant reduction in those monthly bond purchases. This would make sense, especially if, as Powell indicated, the Fed sees the recovery continuing. Finally, a word about the politics behind the scenes yesterday. From my point of view, Powell's tenure on the Fed has been that of a pragmatist. Trained as a lawyer, the first non-economist in quite a while, Powell has impressed me as one who just works to get the job done. Clearly, this has fallen far short of the aims and desires of Ms. Warren and likely Ms. Brown. But I wonder if we really need a more ideological chairman at this time in our economic history. Be careful what you wish for, senators. Sometimes it's the pragmatist that can get you through a rough time.
Well, I've never done it, but today seems like one of those whitewater kayak rides, tumbling, turning constantly, heading in different directions. It's certainly difficult for anyone to get their bearings. Now, last night, the Senate struck a deal so that the government would not shut down at midnight tonight. That's the good news. And it avoids a real catastrophe. But as to raising the debt ceiling, needed in a couple of weeks, or passing President Biden's infrastructure plan, or even coming up with a real budget for the federal government, all 3 of those critical pieces of legislation remain in limbo, as a significant number of legislators remain opposed to aspects in each of them. Then last night came the word that the world's primary manufacturing hub, China, may be sinking into contraction. That's right, by at least one measure, the Purchasing Managers Index, China has just slipped into contraction. This would be a real blow to the scenario that we're in a solid economy right now. And it may portend another winter of economic lockdown, precisely what is happening in some of the cities of China as they deal with the Delta variant. Staying in China, last night both Japan and South Korea reported declines in their monthly industrial production, giving credence to that Chinese PMI reading. Riding the wave over to the USA, things are looking much better here. In the number one watched report today, corporate profits, U.S. corporate profits exceeded even Wall Street's most optimistic predictions, coming in with a 10.5% gain for the second quarter. The earlier estimate of profits had profits up just 4.5%, so this is a big boost in profits. And that means that right now Wall Street analysts are busy slapping a multiple on those profits, and voila, there's the new street projection for the where the market is headed. Profits times multiple equals presumed market value. This will be a real boost to stock market bulls. Now, GDP growth for the second quarter also exceeded the street's estimates, coming in at a 6.7% growth rate for Q2. This helps confirm those stellar corporate profits. Now, the Street will find disappointing, however, the PCE inflation number, which came in very hot at 6.7%. And there was a big jump in initial claims for unemployment, way up at 362,000 initial claims. But let's not spoil the moment. The focus of Wall Street will be those beautiful corporate profits. Once again, corporate profits up an astonishing 10.5% for the second quarter. Well, there's an old Wall Street expression for what happened yesterday afternoon. They call it window dressing, and it harkens back to the days when department stores would have big display windows at the front of their stores. They were carefully designed to bring you into the store. In the same way, these end-of-quarter window dressing times give mutual funds, hedge funds, or money managers a chance to appeal to investors. It's that last day of the quarter's portfolio which will appear in their quarterly statements and say to all the world, look, here's what we invest in. It's an opportunity to put that hot oil stock, for instance, in their portfolio as if you've been riding the energy wave all along. In other words, it's a chance to say to the world, look at us. Well, yesterday saw one of the worst window dressing times I've ever seen. If you noticed, a wave of selling hit the market beginning at about 3:30 yesterday afternoon. This was not the various funds getting into the latest hot new investment sector. This was the funds hitting the sell button. Get me out of this market, was the sentiment. And it may mark a real transition in professional money managers' approach. Throughout the past decade, the mantra on Wall Street has been to buy the dip. Well, I cleaned that up a bit, but you get the gist. The big guys on Wall Street have played off the Fed support for financials, and every time the market would swoon, there were the big funds to step in and buy with both fists. The question we have to ask this morning is whether this approach to the market has now changed. Selling at the end of last quarter, like they did yesterday, absolutely locked in lower performance for these funds, something that they would have only done if they felt they needed to take this action. Now, if you noticed real carefully, all of the last-minute selling yesterday drove down the prices of their favorite stocks. From unchanged, Google and Amazon went to 0.5% down, while Microsoft and Apple went to nearly a percentage point down. Now multiply that decline by a few thousand shares that each of these funds have in their portfolio, and you can see that this was a very big move, and not taken lightly. Whether this was a computer-generated move, however, is the question. Were the algos hitting the automatic stops, or whether this was a real change in valuation, we won't really know for some time. And remember, all three of the major averages did break their 100-day moving average at about the same time. So this all could be just the computer's hiccup. A market drop through the 100-day moving average, and you automatically sell. Or it could be that the funds are seeing a decline in forward earnings and decided that now was the time to hit the sell button. Either way, those quarterly reports are going to look much worse than they could have, and window dressing may never be the same. And that's the value side for Friday, October 1st. I'm David Revelle. Please join me in praying that our country may get back to work.